Daniel Pemberton.
Hello, Paul Morley.
Fantastic to hear you. Did you have any formal music training when you were younger?
When I was very young, I got taught the violin when I was about five. My parents sort of pushed me into learning the violin when I was about five or six, and I was crap. And I think I lasted a couple of weeks and gave up. And I think then decided that I then, to this day, still, that made me decide that I wasn't a musical person. And then I sort of had some piano and guitar lessons at school and got to about grade two, and then kind of got a bit bored playing other people's music. And I'd always kind of go off on my own tangent. So I sort of had a bit, but not really. You know, I had a bit of, you know, doing music GCSE, but like not, I wouldn't really say I had a formal education. And I still feel a bit of a fraud in the sense that I don't feel like I'm a, you know, a musical, you know, I wasn't brought up as a academically, musically.
Yes.
I've just sort of chanced it and taught myself sort of thing.
So what motivated you to start composing, start putting together your own pieces of music?
I was really into electronic music when I was younger. You know, people like The Isle of Noise and Jean-Michel Jarre and all these like slightly uncool bands, which I still think they actually got some amazing stuff. And I think there's kind of the ambient around 92, kind of ambient music happened, and it didn't happen, but you know, it kind of kicked off. Mm. And I'd sort of bought a synthesizer and was just fiddling around with it, sort of really crappy, cheap Yamaha, sort of one of those ones with the auto rhythms. And then this new kind of music that had no form, kind of, I discovered. I remember the Orbs, Little Fluffy Clouds, which I bought in Woolworths in Devon, and I remember thinking, this is amazing, this is like 40 minutes and it doesn't do anything, it's just noise. That got me really excited, and I think that was a really good moment for me. And I'd already started absorbing a lot of electronic music because there wasn't very much then. It was still quite a niche.
Yes.
There's bands like The Grid.
Yeah.
And I think through that, I just got really excited by sound.
Yes.
And just bought a four track and then just started making my own music for just sort of fun.
Mm.
And then I kind of, from that, I went, I did an album of like sort of weird electronic stuff, and then met a director through that. And then I started working on TV things, and then basically kept blagging it and saying I could do things which I couldn't.
Yes.
And then had to learn them very, very quickly.
I'm saying this because it becomes apparent why a bit later on, but you were born in 1977. Because I think that's kind of interesting in terms of, you know, when you begin to start to like music. You were basically making an album when you were 16, weren't you? So we were in the early 90s, and you're here in the Orb, and you've been, like you said, you like Jean-Michel Jarre, and I think you like Tomito as well, people like that, and you're Vangelis.
Yeah.
And then the Orb comes along, and it's sort of, you can sort of make connections there, can't
you?
Yeah. But I think you're into video games as well, aren't you, and computer games at that point very much?
Yeah, well, I grew up, I kind of had this weird thing where I used to write about video games when I was about 13, which even to this day actually is really odd. And
what, review them or?
Yeah. I used to write a cheats column in a great magazine called Game Zone, which is where Charlie Brooker started.
Okay.
It was a really amazing, it's amazing private eye sort of Viz video game magazine. There's that and Zero, which I still think were, you know, really great. You know, when you work on a magazine, it's just a great moment, you know, it's not like, there's nothing like that now. And with the money I got from that, I started putting that into buying music equipment.
Mm.
But yeah, I kind of grew up on video games, and like, you know, I used to write a lot. I mean, I stopped writing about video games now, but I used to write a lot just purely because I felt video games weren't seen. I mean, I think they are a bit more now. They're still not seen as a proper cultural force because I think they're really, really important. And, you know, the media is still really slow to catch on to that. They're only just not treating video games as this kind of nerdy phenomenon or something that makes lots of money. They you know, people still don't really see the kind of, you know, the actual art and craft that goes into them.
Mm. But I suppose also that was oddly an influence on your musical thinking because of the way that those things used sounds and signals as part of their process.
Yeah, I think so. I think, like, you know, the way I've grown up, all the sort of things I've absorbed have definitely influenced me in the way I work. You know, I started making, you know, first thing I started making music on was an Amiga, not an Atari. I was going to buy an Atari, but I got talked out of it by a friend called Paul Bush, who I haven't spoken to for years. If he ever hears this, which I'm sure he won't, I'm very grateful to Paul Bush for making me buy an Amiga.
And why was that? Why was that?
Well, I started using this thing called ProTracker, which is just this really crappy piece of software where you can get samples at about that. Oh, I mean, it's probably about as powerful as a Fairlight, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was making really bad rave, like kind of not even rave music, because you couldn't even get a loop. You just get. And that was that kind of like very punky synthesizer-y sort of sound, which a lot, you know, was in video games, that kind of, because video games, it wasn't really till that sort of 16-bit era where video games could kind of almost sound real. And I think actually the 8-bit stuff is actually, you look back on it now, it's really interesting, the stuff that's done on the Commodore 64. I mean, there's amazing. This, I don't know if you ever, do you know about the Commodore 64 music scene? There's this insane scene,
yeah,
of people who are obsessed with music made on the Commodore 64, and they do club nights, and they have rock bands play like the loading music from Rambo First Blood on Ocean Software or something, and they'll have a whole rock band play it, and it's weird, but you know, it's kind of cool.
Yeah, yeah. And did you have any? You started doing like remixes, didn't you? And I guess you were doing things for Ninja Tune and things like that. Kind of quite cool, cutting edge, sort of avant garde hip hop places. Yeah. I mean, did you have a career idea of what you wanted to be as a musician, or
not really? I kind of I've sort of always wanted to not like this doesn't sound right, but I've always kind of not wanted to do what everyone else did, and I think the Ninja Tune was just, I really like what Ninja Tune were doing. And I was just kind of, I somehow got some kind of in there. I'd done some stuff with Cold Cut. So I did a bit of that, but I wasn't really, it was like, I'm a bit too musical, which is sometimes is a bit of a downfall, because you don't want to, I get bored just having one loop going over and over again for like, you know, 10 seconds for me. I'm like, oh, let's put something else in there. And I'm a kind of like throw as much in as I can, which isn't always a good thing. Mm. And so I didn't always fit with that kind of, that scene so well. Mm. But yeah, I mean, the stuff on Instagram, that was a really great time for me. I really enjoyed that whole moment with like kind of Moax and Instagram was a really kind of exciting moment. But I think deep down, I still wanted to do kind of weirder, more filmic sort of stuff.
Yes.
And I sort of career-wise, I'd done this album, and then I'd done this next album, which was going to go out with Massive Attack's Melancholic label. But Virgin didn't really like it because it was the first sort of release on their label. And because it was a bit weird. It was all still a bit avant-garde-y.
Mm-hmm.
And so it kind of got, you know, they sort of said it kind of got canned. And I sort of thought, oh, this is shit, man. You don't, people decide.
Yeah.
And I also remember seeing an interview that the people in the office deciding what tracks went on a record. And I thought, this is shit. I don't want people to decide what goes on my record. So I kind of got quite disillusioned with the music industry, which in retrospect was a really good move.
Yes, yes. And did you have any TV composing heroes? I mean, I was talking to Colin Greenwood the other day, and he was mentioning how Johnny Greenwood wasn't a fan for Kraftwerk for many, many years, and then suddenly liked Kraftwerk. And one of the reasons he liked Kraftwerk, oddly enough, is because they reminded him, and at first I didn't quite know what he meant, and then I sort of did, they reminded him a little bit of Ronnie Hazelhurst, in terms of the way that they could compress quite interesting musical ideas, very catchy musical ideas into incredibly, you know, beautiful little moments.
Yeah.
And I kind of knew what it meant, and therefore also what the function is of a TV composer.
Yeah, I think, like, I wasn't particularly aware of composers per se, but I'd be very aware of certain theme tunes, which I would love. I mean, I would watch TV shows purely because I like the theme tunes. And it's only when I sort of had become a TV composer, I sort of kind of remembered that. I was like, oh, yeah, that kind of makes sense why I'm doing this in a way.
What were your favourites? What did you like?
Oh, I really like the Great Egg Race. The Great Egg Race theme tune is amazing. I like Rhubarb and Custard, Doctor Who, Treasure Hunt was pretty good. Knight Rider. I just got the Knight Rider soundtracks recently, and they're fucking amazing. like really, like compared to stuff that, I mean, they redid Knight Rider and I saw the trailer and it just started like boom, 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 boom. I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. And it's just like the bass line. And then just went into this shit kind of, you know, just thrash rock kind of demographic music. You know, when they say, hey, this got to be young and hip and we'll just put a rock band on it. And it's just awful. And I heard this, you know, some of the old music and it's brilliant. It's like electronics with like a live band. I don't think it was sequenced because I don't know how they'd have sequenced it properly. Yeah. And it's just kind of, you know, crazy, funky sort of synth funk, but like held back rather than millions of keyboard solos over it and things.
Yeah.
And, you know, today, listening to that today, I mean, I listened to it, I just got goosebumps. I was like, this is such an amazing theme tune. I mean, it's minimal. It's got all these noises. You instantly recognize it as Knight Rider. And it's, you know, it's really cool.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's what I was thinking about. Something like Ronnie Hazelhurst, Are You Being Served, the way he uses the Castile. Yeah. Sort of like Pink Floyd and Money or something, you know. But they're effects. And it's almost it's sort of pre-sampled electronic effects that are being used in these sort of 30-second, 60-second yeah. moments, you know.
Well, if I'm doing a job, I always try and, like, one of the things I really like about being a, like, sort of TV composer is it's kind of like, each time you do a new job, it's like starting a new band.
Yes.
So I normally try and come up with a different, like, you know, lineup for each thing. So you'll do, I'll always try and get weird noises in because it's a really good way of instantly connecting that music with the show. So you'll do things like, I did a show called Bad Lad's Army and that was like really good fun. I did whistling and kazoos. Mm. And then you do other things like, I don't know, like Peep Show, for instance, I just had all these kind of like weird sort of noises. And it's, you give yourself a small palette to work with, and then you can, once you limit yourself that palette, you know that's the sound of that show.
But it's kind of interesting because you're sort of using almost experimental music lineups to create the most, you know, the music that has to be very accessible and very instant.
Yeah. Yeah, I think like I find that, like, if you want to connect with music, you can either do it through sound, you can have an interesting sound, or you do it through melody. So if you've got a strong melody that's really strong, you can play it on anything, you hear it a couple of times, you connect, or you do it with a sound that's kind of not necessarily, hopefully, unique, but you know, you'll instantly connect with that and you know, recognize it as the show. And I think one of the things is, so much commercial music is, I don't want to say boring, but everyone does the same thing all the time, half the time, and they're all working to the same principles of radio play or albums, and, you know, the same kind of lineups. I mean, I love all kinds of music, but I do get bored when I just hear a song and I just think, I've heard so many things like this, and there's so many things you can do with music, and, you know, people always do the same thing.
Yes. One of the first times I came across your name was when you got involved in what I think is one of the great kind of controversies in music recently, the Stockhausen thing.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Where Stockhausen got played some various examples of modern electronic music, like Aphex Twin, I think he got played, and Scanner, was it? Rambo, yeah. Rambo. And he got played something by you as well, didn't he?
Yeah.
Now, what did he get? Did he get played from your albums?
That was weird because I was like 16 when that album came out.
Right.
So I was like kind of this, you know, because I was 16, everyone was like, oh, he's 16. So that happened through there. So I thought, I kind of felt like I was slightly the weak link in the chain there.
How did they come across? Why did they put you in that?
I think because I just had that album out and it was kind of interesting. And it's actually really interesting looking back at what he said and my thoughts on that as well. And it's weird, I still feel the same way, where he was kind of saying I was using, you know, melodic intervals, and that was, you know, it was a bit obvious and all this kind of thing, and he liked my avant-garde elements, but, you know, the melody sounded like an ice cream truck or something. And I think, you know, I sort of said what I said then, which I still sort of think now, is it's like being avant-garde just for the sake of it is actually quite easy, I think, just to make weird noises. And, you know, that's I don't find that as challenging. And just making melodic music by the numbers is the same. It's not particularly challenging. But trying to get them both together and infuse them and make sort of music out of avant-garde elements, I find a lot more interesting, but still have a melodic kind of, or some kind of emotional heart. Because there's so many people, you know, I kind of got slightly bored with the ambient-y scene because it was so, it just became people noodling around, just making noises for the sake of it. Mm. And I'm kind of interested in making noises and then using those noises to do something, yeah. because that's where it gets really interesting, where you hear things, you're like, wow, what the hell is that? Like,
sure. Just going back to the Stockhausen thing, it was for the Wire magazine, wasn't yeah. it? And were you aware at the time that it was one of the great icons of 20th century music that was having a comment on your music?
Yeah, I was. I mean, not as much as I probably am now. I mean, I was aware of his stuff and I had listened to like a fair bit of it. I really still totally get off on that kind of music and that way of thinking. And I love just that thinking about sound. And, you know, it's kind of weird. I don't know if you, like, through my life, I've just continually moved from all these different sort of camps, which has been really good because yes. it's kind of like you just pick up ideas from each place. And sometimes they're great ideas and sometimes they're shit. And personally, they change for me all the time. Sometimes I want to be very experimental, and other times, like, I won't be. Like, I did a TV score recently, and I came up with this concept that was more a concept rather than a musical idea, and it mm-hmm. was just about, it was about child abuse. It was this drama called Forgiven, and this guy was disinterested, you know, he was abusing his kid, and it was, as the film progressed, he was kind of denying it, and he would eventually break down. But I wanted to think of a way of doing this. And so I recorded a load of piano music and then bit crushed it, which is where you know, if you have something at like 32-bit or 24-bit, it's very clear. If you have it at like 8-bit, like a spectrum, it sounds like... You have it at 1-bit, it's just distortion. So I would very slowly over whole cues, or depending where you were in the film, reprocess them. So it would start at, like, you know, full bit rate and then go down to one over this one scene that was about 2 minutes. But you do it so gradually that by the time you get to the end, you don't realise what's happened and you're just left with distortion. But at the beginning, you start with a piano piece. And that was definitely influenced by kind of this kind of more avant-garde background.
Because that in that kind of ultimately wordless music, instrumental music, enables you to incorporate all those influences you've been talking about, really, as far out as they sometimes go.
Yeah.
So that you can hear the electronic music definitely in there, but also the fact that you can be playful, I guess it is, as well, and extremely experimental to create something that's actually going on mainstream television.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of, you know, it's really good fun because sometimes you just think, right, like, at the moment I'm doing this kind of orchestral glam rock thing, which is just fun. It's just, you know, I'm doing, like, orchestral music with a sort of yes. kind of beat.
And that's for?
It's a BBC Two series called Desperate Romantics. And then, you know, previously I remember doing this thing on, I did this thing on Jill Dando ages ago, a documentary, and it was all about surveillance and things. So I decided to make every sound out of electronic equipment. So I got a little contact mic and just went and stuck it on microwaves, cookers, CD players, which make really cool noises. And you just get this kind of, cut it all up, turned them all into loops, made tones out of them.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was a completely different way to working with, like, a big orchestra. And it's yeah. just fun to just continually jump.
And what kind of a framework, what kind of context is the fact that it ultimately, for all that play and experimentation, has to be extremely commercial? And often you're doing, like, lifestyle programmes as well with their own parameters.
Yeah, I mean, I do actually really get off on getting stuff that is, like, successful and mainstream, because I really like that kind of trying to slightly subvert. I mean, I don't want to say subvert, because, you know, I'll do some shows and you can't. It's a cooking show with two chefs battling and it's on BBC Two at 6:30. And, as you know, you'll try and get some wacky things in there and you'll pick stuff up just off, you know, just records, just little techniques that are just production techniques. And I guess they kind of change it. I mean, you know, often I just want to do good music. And I think, you know, sometimes you need that rock song or whatever that is just melodic with a guitar because it will work. But I mean, I do really get off on getting weird stuff. I mean, Bad Lads Army, like, was one of my favourites in the sense that, I mean, it was just bonkers. I was just, they let me get away with anything. Yeah. So I was just like, okay, I can do, I end up doing this thing, singing down a tube that was like, oh, la, 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 la. And then put it through like a Leslie pedal, and then, and it's like me singing on TV, and I'm like, I can't sing. For I mean, I'm really, really bad singer.
But I kind of like it when you have sort of hit singles, because for me, one of the beauties of watching a programme like Great British Menu is the music.
Yeah.
Down, 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 down.
Yeah.
Down, 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 down.
Yeah.
I get off on it, and I love the fact it keeps coming back in different forms and different ways. And it's obviously like novelty music in a sense, but it's obviously got something else going on. And I wonder if that is because you come from the background you've come from, and that's sort of in the DNA of it. It isn't sort of Simon Mayo or anything. There's something else going on.
Well, I think with it, I always try to make, like that one, for instance, the band I decided I wanted to do was it was kind of Square Dance by Dave Brubeck. You know,
okay.
Bong, 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 bong. So I was kind of thinking, I got told about the show, and I'm like, oh, it's a cooking show. Not another cooking show.
Does that make your heart sink sometimes when you get a new brief? Or any kind of brief when it's like that? It's like, oh, here we go again.
Look, some briefs are great. Once you can work out what it is. So, like, that was good. Something like Hell's Kitchen's good, because you're like, it's about hell. You know, there's something to grab on. When it's just... you know, someone cooking and it's, isn't their life great? That's where it gets complicated. But with Great British Menu, it was good because it was like, it was meant to be like a class, you know, it was meant to be like a higher end kind of show and like classy stuff. So, and for some reason, I remember hearing that track and just thinking, logging it in my head, thinking that's a really good track for doing something that's cool, but is still kind of mainstream.
Mm.
You know, you hear little, there's like tracks you just pick up that, quite avant-garde, but they'll work on like, what's that one, the Whistler, do 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 do, I can't remember, it's an old 20s track, and it's just a great track, and you just, you know, you pick them up and you just mentally log tracks as kind of ideas for, and then you'll just expand it over a whole show. And I was lucky with that show because it was a good tune. It does actually sound like, I didn't realize this, but I did later, it sounds like disco. D-I-S-C-O. Again, that was just trying to do a strong tune, and it's been good. They just play it over and over again.
So. It's also the idea of what a function is of a musician. You know, I mean, on one hand, you can have no framework at all, no context at all, and just fly off into the dust, if you like. Whereas you have very tight commercial frameworks, and also it's still a world where it can be lucrative. You know, you can earn money, you can make a living out of being a musician. Well, obviously these days it's harder and harder for musicians to make a living. You found this wonderful area where still with a little sense of play and experimenting, it can be very lucrative.
Yeah, I mean, it's good. I do think the other reason I've been very good at doing TV stuff is because I haven't had to sit and say, oh, what do I represent musically?
Yes.
Because I have tried to do that, and I'm really glad in some ways I kind of stopped doing the music industry thing early on. I mean, I haven't stopped it. I'll still do things, but I really hope this will change in the next 5, 10 years, whatever, because the way it built up was you can only do one thing. You have to become a brand of like one type of music, and that's all you do.
Mm.
And I actually think it's really damaging to music as a whole, because I think what I discovered, you know, I would have been typecast as ambient, electronic-y. You know, I've discovered I can write all these different kinds of music, and some things I'm better at, some things I'm not so good at.
Mm.
But, you know, I've, like, from doing stuff in my bedroom, I've gone on to do, like, orchestras, choirs, like, weird sampling shit, like, rock band. You know, it's just great to... Mm. And it's really great to have that opportunity to, you know, actually have budgets and do things and not worry about it so much, not be precious, because I think another big influence on me was Ennio Morricone, and I sort of decided that I would adhere to the Ennio Morricone principle of just continually writing, and you might pump out some shit. And he definitely pumped out some crap, but, you know, he pumped out so much amazing stuff, which is just as a result of him continually working. And you always forget the rubbish, you know. Look at David Bowie. You know, you forget the rubbish. And it's that kind of technique of just not being precious. Mm. And you know, I still admire that kind of like, I'll put three albums out and they'll be amazing idea. Mm. But I actually, that wouldn't work for me. I have to just keep working and something good will pop up every now and again, hopefully.
And how do you think you're perceived by other musicians? Do you think you're perceived as a musician or as a kind of a new, different kind of craftsman almost? It's a different kind of craft.
I don't think, it's kind of weird. I mean, even doing this interview is kind of quite interesting for me because I don't think I have, like, I don't really think I have any perception by anyone. It's really, like, what I do is really interesting in the sense that there is no kind of critical analysis. Hmm. Of it, which is in some ways annoying because you know I'll slog my guts out on something and people won't even notice it, and it's
but they kind of do. You kind of have hits because it's in people's heads all the time for a very short period of time, like an old-fashioned hit for about 6 weeks. It's just always there. But you're kind of anonymous.
I mean, which is, in some ways is great because it kind of means I don't, you know, get too full of myself and think I'm the bee's knees. And so you're continually thinking, you know, the person I've generally got to please is myself. I've kind of got to please directors and all. But at the end of the day, I'm more concerned with how I feel about what I've done. Mm. Does it feel... I always hate what I've done normally when I finished it. And then it's always like the 2 years down the line. If I re-listen to it, is it good? Mm. And yeah, you have to, it's just kind of like keeping yourself on your toes and kind of keeping yourself... excited, because I write best when I sort of don't know what I'm doing. I'm sort of like finding it out for the first time in a way.
Do you still have ambitions to do a Morricone or a Vangelis level of thing, or do you think by being in TV you've stopped that happening because that world wouldn't take you seriously enough?
I think it's kind of weird. I've been moving a lot more into like sort of bigger dramas. I did this thing Occupation, the Iraq War thing that was on last week, and this new series. And they're all a lot more highbrow. And once you do drama, you're sort of not meant to carry on doing cooking shows and reality shows. And so I'm having that thing, do I play by those rules? Because it's a tricky one. Cause
it's like you're making your triple albums. You're also still making your novelty hit singles at the same time.
And I do like, you know, I'm kind of thinking, well, maybe I'll do them both. Because I like that influence those things have on people's lives. They kind of, without you knowing it, they are... That is your summer of that year, or you hear it a couple every year. You know, it kind of. I think if you write good stuff, at the end of the day, if you write good stuff, no one gives a shit. If you write good, interesting music,
but it's difficult to judge how that would be with you, because like something like Great British Menu, it goes through many levels. There's a moment when I think, you know what, I quite like that music, and then I really hate it because it keeps coming, and then I go back to liking it again because I like the way it becomes part of the form of the program.
And
the program takes on a weird structure that's beyond it being just about cookery or whatever it's about. It's got it's got another presence somehow, so you go through all sorts of stages with it, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird. I mean, I was... Yeah, sometimes you just write... Like, I was very lucky with that because that was a good... It's a good tune and it was recorded quite well. Because sometimes you just... Like, I'm doing something at the moment it's just been executive hell. It's gone through so many different levels of crap. I had all these amazing ideas for it at the beginning. They're not in it. It's now a bit of a mess. Musically... And it's just like, we've just got to get it finished. And that's kind of annoying, because that's one thing where it is annoying being a composer, because, you know, if you're an artist in a way, you can put your name on something and say, that's me. Whereas, you know, I occasionally have to put my name on things and they aren't necessarily exactly how I'd want them.
No, I don't know if you know, but I've just, having sort of been occasionally in areas a bit like you where I've made electronic music or been involved with sampling and compiling stuff out of music in different ways. I've just spent a year at the Royal Academy actually learning notation. I've been studying composition. it's kind of interesting because I was wondering what that would do to me as a music lover and a music listener and a music writer, and also the way I made music, you know. So it was kind of a risk, if you like. I just wondered if you've ever thought of anything like that, making your musical knowledge more formal, or whether you would think that might ruin whatever instincts and intuitions you actually have as a composer that you think are working for you.
Yeah, I do think about it quite a lot. I've had, I definitely over the last 10 years, like my kind of knowledge is, like just from working with orchestras, it's just gone, whew. Mm. You know, I can instantly hear things and I know like that chord's going to sound way better if we put a bass on it, like an octave lower, that is going to give it the whoomph. You know, you learn about dynamics, all these little things, which you realise make a massive difference in, like, you know, a classical piece. Mm. But I've kind of, like, decided that, no, I will be a bit crap. Because I think all my favourite composers are, like, are sort of from a more poppy background who end up doing it. And they kind of have a... it's like one of those things, if you know too much, like, oh, you know too much on certain things. Mm-hmm. And I try and be clever the whole time. And sometimes I will sit around... I'm always trying to do things that I want to do things that haven't been done before or aren't the usual way of doing things. Sometimes I'll do something and I'll watch it back later and I'll be like, oh, that's shit. Why didn't I just go for what was the most obvious thing to do? So I think there's something to be said about just having the kind of gut reaction, you know, the kind of like four chords with a good, like if you look at John Barry, his stuff is really simple often. It's like, you know, it's like a couple of chords, a nice melody, repeated over and over again in different octaves. Mm. But his music's beautiful. And you look at someone like, you know, Jerry Goldsmith, who is amazingly talented and, you know, his music works amazingly in films, but I don't listen to many of his like, scores because they're too fiddly. Mm. But, you know, I've definitely learned, you know, you just continually pick things up. It's kind of... You know, you must have found it. I don't know how you found it. Like,
well, I think what you're saying in a way is what I've found is that the more you do know, the more you realise you've got to know, and that can become quite intimidating.
Yeah.
Because you think you've cracked it in the first few months. Oh, I see. And then you suddenly realise that you're beginning something that may never end, and that can become intimidating. So to an extent, even though it's, I don't have to do it like you do it. Or, yeah. You know, it's absolute central to what you do. So it's been a risk worth taking, and I think it's might improve me as a critic, but I think as a musician who's been able to succeed in the way that you have, for instance, there would be certain risks involved, I think.
Yeah.
You know, whether it would actually completely destroy... It's like my analogy for it has been a bit like a professional golfer changing his swing suddenly.
Yeah.
You know, would you lose what you had that was doing all right, but you wanted to become the best in the world, and by trying to change your swing, you forget everything.
Yeah. Whereas, like, there's a lot of people who've come up, you know, their composers have come up through the kind of Royal Academy route, or they've come up through the techie route, and I've kind of got that... good ground where I'm slightly in the middle of either camps, which is kind of how I've always been, you know, at school. I wasn't really friends with the sort of sporty kids or the nerdy kids, just kind of in the middle. Yes. Like, so I've always found myself slightly out of the loop with everyone, which actually works out quite good. Mm. Because I think when, like, the first time I did an orchestral session, I was just so scared. Mm. I was so scared. I couldn't sleep. I still have like weird dreams the night before sessions. Mm. And when I did it, I was like, wow, that's it. That's all you have to do. This is easy. and I think the first time you do it, you get such an amazing buzz from hearing an orchestra play your stuff. Yeah. And it's actually not that hard to write for an orchestra. Anyone, it's like playing a guitar. Anyone with a bit of practice can do it. But doing it well, that is amazing. That's like a whole, it's that immediacy of a sound. You know, if you've got a guitar and you just hit it, you're like, hey, I can do this.
Yeah.
Whereas you want to play it really well,
like
a virtuoso, an orchestra is just the most complicated head fuck of all time.
Yes, absolutely.
So I kind of cheat by thinking, there's a million people better at that than me.
Yeah.
So why don't I work on, you know, maybe I'd be the guy who plays a ruler with an orchestra, because no one's done that.
Mm.
And that can be my niche of just...
Now, I haven't prepared you for this, so it may be a bad question to ask you, but I was just wondering if classical music, you've got some classical music favourites, or has classical music come to you indirectly through people like Vangelis and Tometa?
I'm trying to think who I really love, like, I feel like big connections with. Like, I mean, I really love Debussy. And Eric Satie, especially Eric Sardi, just it's kind of one of those things. It's a bit cliched because you hear it so much, but it's so amazing. It's so like minimal and beautiful. I really love Arvo Pärt. I don't know if you ever heard Alina. Have you ever heard that? I mean, yes, that's like one of the most. The first time I heard that, I was like, this is the most beautiful piece of music. I mean, this is like, I was actually on a plane, slightly hungover, and someone had told me to buy it. I was listening to it on my iPod. I was just like literally crying, looking out the window. I was like, this guy has unlocked every secret of music. In like, all it is like an F major chord with something. Yes. And I mean, he's a really interesting example because there is a piece of music which is not that complicated. It's actually very simple, but emotionally, is like for me so powerful. Like, you know, it's such an amazing, and it's quite modern in a way because it's not frilly. It's, and that's kind of the stuff I think I kind of feel more in tune with.
Yes.
But at the same time, you know, I love like big Beethoven numbers or, you know, any of that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, I'm very pleased that you've said that, Daniel, because now from the composer of The Great British Menu theme tune, we can end with some Arvo Pärt.
Yeah.
Which I think it's just, that's kind of, I think, sums up what's going on in your head when you write that music.
Yeah. Well, it's the same. It's actually, he's got quite a block.
Yeah.
Way, like a lot of the modern, like Philip Glass and stuff, it's a lot of lines.
Yeah.
And a lot of that is, I think, to do sequencing.
Mm.
But, you know, you look around us, we're like lines. Everything is kind of lines.
Yes.
Whereas you look in like 18th century, it'd be a lot more intricate, you know. And it's kind of interesting how the music you respond to is lines and blocks.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Daniel.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.